ring the bell. Anti-tractionists?
This is Movie Fighters. It's the show where I, Matt Wilson, and Chris Sims, we watch movies and beat them up. And Chris, we're going with one you felt compelled to recommend this month.
Yes, because I saw this movie in theaters months ago, and I came out of the theater wanting to do this on Movie Fighters, but I did not feel like I could ask you to go spend money on it.
I did end up spending $1.50 on it.
Did you? I thought it was on HBO now.
It is not.
Well, there you go.
I went to the Redbox and rented, not a Blu-ray, a DVD.
Oh, you should have gotten it in Blu-ray, Matt.
Did I miss, like, some of the crisp visuals by only watching a DVD?
I mean, I will say, folks, we're watching Mortal Engines. Mm-hmm. That's the movie about what if City was Tank, as our good friend Charlotte put it.
What if City was Tank?
What if City was Tank? I will say, one of the reasons I want to do this movie, I came into this thing saying, this is the best bad movie in years. And by that, I mean that it is dumb as a bag of hammers, but it is also infinitely watchable. And part of the reason for that is that it actually is a very good-looking movie. So I think maybe Matt, you might have missed some stuff.
Maybe
there's so many lines that you didn't get, not getting it in 4K.
Maybe you're right. I watched it in regular old 720p.
Mm-hmm.
So maybe I did miss something. But whatever the case, I have seen the film. We've both seen the film. So we're not going to try to pretend like we haven't watched it. But I would like to talk about kind of where I was coming from when I watched this.
Okay.
Because I knew nothing. I had no familiarity with the book that this is based on, which there's a series of four books that this movie – the series – this movie is based on the first one, but the series has four books.
I cannot wait to see the three sequels.
Well,
to this
Chris,
movie that are absolutely going to happen.
I do have some bad news for you.
Oh no!
This movie had a budget of somewhere between $100 and $150 million.
Mm-hmm.
Wikipedia is not sure about it. It made $83.6 million.
Shocking.
It is said to have lost the studio $175 million.
That's not funny. A lot of people worked very hard on this. It's not good, though.
That is wild.
Yeah, that is, it really is.
A wild amount of money to lose. According to Wikipedia, in the United States and Canada, Mortal Engines was released along Spider-Man Into the Spider-Verse and The Mule, and was initially projected to gross $10 to $13 million on its opening weekend. It only made $2.8 million on its first day, and then it debuted at $7.5
million. Yeah, and I do want to point out, I saw this one before I saw Spider-Verse. When I went to the theater and I had to make a choice, I was like, two for Mortal Engines, please. But because I was saving Spider-Verse for Christmas Day. I knew Spider-Verse wouldn't get anywhere.
Yeah.
But, like, I definitely was like, hey, babe, do you want to go to the movie theater and watch the movie about what a city was Tank?
My favorite film critic, Peter Bradshaw, described this movie as steampunk Star Wars with a bit of low-octane Gilliam and Gaiman on the side.
It's a story.
It is a story, isn't it, about if a city was Tank?
What if City was Tank?
But see, okay, dumb as a bag of hammers, absolutely. Also, dumb as if the basic overriding concept is a city on wheels. Like,
yes,
there's a city, and it's on wheels. But
which, I'm not going to lie, I fucking love that.
I mean, it's dumb, but so many of the high concepts for so many of the things we like are also dumb.
Yeah, and I think the movie's best stuff genuinely, the best stuff in the movie is when they're like, by the way, this movie is about what if cities were giant monster trucks and people lived on them and they were cities, but they were also giant monster trucks.
All right, let's not get too much into the content of the film, though.
I mean, that's the entirety of the content of the film, but yes, go on.
It's not, though, and I want to get into that. I wasn't familiar with the book. I didn't realize it was written by essentially the writing team behind the Lord of the Rings movies.
Yeah, this is a Peach joint.
And The Hobbit, because it's Peter Jackson, his wife Fran Walsh, and their frequent writing partner Philippa Boyens. Which the three of them wrote all of the Lord of the Rings movies together.
And I believe old Peach was originally set to direct it, but did not for whatever reason.
He selected Christian Rivers, a special effects guy.
Sounds like the name that a person would have in a bad allegory.
Yeah, you're right. But Christian Rivers was handpicked by Peter Jackson to direct this movie. That's how he ended up directing this Peter Jackson joint, because he had done a bunch of he's been with Peter Jackson since Braindead, since the movie Americans Know Is Dead Alive, and they've been doing movies together ever since then, up through the Hobbit films. So he's a longtime collaborator of Peter Jackson's, yeah. And like based on like, again, visually. This could be a Peter Jackson movie, probably.
Well, the thing that I said, and I maybe should have saved this for final thoughts, but I think we'll get some stuff in the discussion. The thing I said was that I wanted this movie to do well enough that I could buy a book that was like The Art of Mortal Engines, like a coffee table book with all the designs and all the art. But I also wanted it to flop hard enough that I could get that book for $6. Which, unfortunately, I think only the second half of that came true.
Yeah, I don't think you got the enough success for the book. I believe that book will not be coming out.
Yeah, sadly.
Let's see if there's any interesting trivia about this book on IMDb. Author Philip Reeve, writer of the novel on which the movie is based, said most of it looked very much like I'd imagined, except for the bits which looked better. So the author was very up on the movie.
And it, you know, honestly, makes sense that he would be. Having read the summaries of the future Mortal Engines novels,
It's a fine-looking film. Let's see. As per usual in an adaptation of a young adult fantasy novel, the ages of the protagonists are all pushed up a bit. In the book, Tom and Hester are 17, with Catherine Valentine 16, and Bevis Pod is 18. Everybody in the movie is like mid to late 20s.
Yeah, it's a fucking Final Fantasy game.
Shipped to cinemas under the pseudonym Squeaky Wheels.
Hilarious.
It's a USA New Zealand co-production, which I think will be of interest when we get into some of the themes of the film. Nothing else is particularly interesting.
Nope. Much like the movie.
So I think we're just going to take a quick pause here and watch the movie. But before we do that, Chris, it's time for the hottest segment in all of podcasting. It's time for Snack Situation.
Now, Matt, as you previously mentioned, we've pre-watched this film.
We have.
So we will not be taking a break of 2 hours right now, during which we will require sustenance. But I did eat a snack.
I'm eating a snack currently. I'm actually eating dessert.
My snack was also dessert.
Because it's the desserting time. It's post-dinner.
It's the dessert hour. Yeah. What did you have for dinner?
I had some pizza.
Ooh, what kind of pizza? Like, did you make it? Was it delivery?
It was frozen pizza. It wasn't good.
Oh, okay. I'm sorry.
But, you know, I wanted something quick and easy and that I had in the house. And I did add some fresh mozzarella to the top because
that's good.
I got to give myself a little something.
Yeah.
But if since I gave my dinner, I guess I'll give my snack. I am enjoying some iced cream.
Matt, we might have the same snack situation. This might be a fucking somewhere out there situation.
I bet these are different. It's in a pint container, and this is Absolute Nutter Peanut Butter Caramel Brownie Premium Ice Cream. It's very good.
I like how you said that. If anyone wants to sample that for a rap song.
Yeah, it's very, there are a lot of rhymes in this, but it's like peanut butter, caramel, and brownie all in one ice cream. It's good.
For dinner, I had local chorizo tacos, which are very good.
Very, sounds great.
I love tacos. Aiden does not care for ground beef, so every now and then when we go to the farmer's market, we'll get some of that local chorizo, which makes a delicious taco. And I have that with, like, local guac, which is also very good. And then for dessert, Matt, I had some ice cream.
Uh-huh.
I had two varieties of ice cream that you can only get from our old friend, Trader Joe.
Oh, the Trader.
Have you ever had the Trader Joe's Coffee Bean Blast?
I have not.
I picked up Coffee Bean Blast because I read an article on The Kitchen. That was like, here's what the Trader Joe's employees say you should be getting. Like, here's what they say. Hey, this is the best stuff we've got. And the Coffee Bean Blast ice cream, which is described on the box as super premium, which is bold.
Super premium. So I know this because I've been to the Ben & Jerry's factory in Vermont. There's an actual demonstrable difference between premium ice cream and super premium.
Ooh.
And it has to do with the amount of air in it.
Interesting.
It's a, like a ratio of air, and super premium ice cream has less air.
That makes sense, because it is a very thick with two C's ice cream with two M's.
Right, yeah.
So Coffee Bean Blast is good, but it's not great. I would say it's not as good as like even a Häagen-Dazs coffee, which is honestly, kind of the gold standard of coffee ice cream, I think, is the Häagen-Dazs, you know, as far as coffee ice cream that you can get from the grocery store. But I topped that shit with a little bit of something I've been curious about. And, buddy, that's the fucking cookie butter ice cream.
Oh, the Speculoos.
The Speculoos? Let me tell you something about that cookie butter ice cream, my dog. You gotta get that shit.
I have done the thing before where you take the cookie butter from the container and add it to, like, vanilla ice cream, which is pretty great. I have not had the pre-made Speculoos cookie butter ice cream, but I would like to try it now.
I mean, that's what it is. It is a vanilla with some Speculoos cookie butter in it. And if you know them Ajax boys, if you know them Clitus Media boys, you'll know that is a that's something that hits our buttons.
Well, you know, folks, it's a hot time. It's heating up. Late spring. It's May. Temperatures are rising. And so your boys got to have a little ice cream. And you need a lot of heat to power a city that's a monster truck.
Mm-hmm.
So we're going to take a little break. Fire up the engines.
The mortal engines.
Come back. You're going to hear an ad and a musical interlude. We're going to come back and talk about mortal engines.
We're going to take a couple minutes to see if we can find that doomsday flash drive.
And we are back from our quick little break. We're going to talk about mortal engines. Chris, I have two main comments about this movie.
Okay.
One is that it's too many things.
It's so many things.
Two is that it's not enough things.
Matt, that is exactly correct. My number one thought about this movie is something I should 100% save. for the end of our discussion, but I'm curious to hear you elaborate on your thoughts.
All right. So if you're familiar, are you familiar, Chris, with the famous television chef Gordon Ramsay?
He's the guy who's mean to everyone except children, who he's very nice to.
Yeah, that's him.
Yeah.
That's the guy. And sometimes he's nice to adults. He's just got to get a lot of his yelling out. Anyway.
He's mean to the adults because the adults should know better.
That's
he's
right.
Nice to the children because they're babies.
Yeah, that's a very good way of describing the famous chef, Gordon Ramsay. Gordon Ramsay has a philosophy about menus.
Mm-hmm.
The menu of a restaurant, he says, should have like a maximum of like 9 items on it.
Gordon's in my kitchen.
Oh, is
he? He's over here with Neil.
Okay, yeah.
Do you want me to go get him?
Yeah, please do.
Okay, hang on a second. Hey, Gordon? Gordon, can you come here for a second?
Just make a really good burger.
Thanks, Gordon. Oh,
he's gone. He's gone. Back to the kitchen.
Gordon, you've helped me make my point. If you have too many things on your menu, he says, then you don't do anything really well. You do a bunch of things middling. It's a lot of mediocre stuff.
Mm-hmm.
If you focus on 8 or 9 things that you're really good at, then you can make them the best.
Right.
This movie is a diner menu with 100 items on it.
Mm-hmm.
That it kind of does, but infuriatingly, it doesn't do anything great. Or it doesn't flesh anything out. And so the things you want to see more of, you don't see enough. And then 20 other things happen where you're like, wait, what's that? What? Because,
mm-hmm.
like, we don't learn anything about the people behind the wall in the East.
Well, we do learn that they are cartoonishly Buddhist.
Sure. Sure. We barely learn anything about the whole notion of the Lazarus Project that brings people back to life as like robotic humanoids.
Cybernetic organisms, or as they are sometimes called, cybernorgs.
They're robocopped.
They are definitely robocopped, yes. They're actually, Matt, they're actually robocopped, dude.
You're right. They are RoboCop.
Is there any movie that the Movie Fighters boys love with a disproportionate love to its quality as RoboCop 2?
I love it. I in particular love one scene of RoboCop 2. You know the one I'm talking about.
It's all you need.
The stuff about like the airships kind of appear out of nowhere.
Mm-hmm.
Even the stuff about what if City was Tank, there could be a lot more of. The only city we really see that is Tank is London.
Yes.
We see some small towns, but like, and some others are mentioned. But here's the thing that really gets me. If you heard about a movie where cities are tanks and they fight each other.
Yeah.
Don't you want to see some more city versus city fights?
And absolutely, 1,000,000%.
Don't you want to? Don't you immediately think like, okay, that's what London looks like as a tank. What does Moscow look like as a tank? What does Paris look like as a tank? What does Rome look like as a tank? And we get none of it.
Here's, I think, the best way to describe the problems with Mortal Engines. Plot and what it chooses to show you. There is one sequence where the city of London, which is a giant tank, fights and eats another city.
Which is like a small town.
It is described as a Bavarian mining village.
Yeah.
There are two scenes where someone finds out, or someone is revealed to have an evil father. And it's the same character. The same character has two evil father reveals.
You're right.
Yeah, that is exactly the problem with Mortal Engines. Which, Matt, I'm going to go ahead and say this now. I was going to save it for the ending.
Okay.
Here's the other problem with Mortal Engines. The end of Mortal Engines They straight up do the ends of all three Star Wars movies in order. Like, you're not going to fucking notice.
All right, let's
like
go through.
Like, when they do a Death Star run, and then someone goes, I'm your evil father.
Yep.
And then they do a second Death Star run that's inside the Death Star. Like, you're not going to go, hey, this is a lot like Star Wars. The audacity, which, again, I kind of love. I listened to this podcast called the Attitude Era podcast, Matt.
Mm-hmm.
And I remember a while ago they were watching something from like the 98, 99, and they were talking about how Billy Gunn, who, if you don't know, was a prominent star, but a mid-card sort of guy, like a B-list.
Spent a lot of time in a tag team.
Yeah.
In one tag team or another.
And they made a note of the fact that one week, or on one show, he did the jackhammer, which was the finishing move of the other company's biggest star. And he just kind of did it in the middle of a match. And then in another match, he did the jackhammer again and then did like a diamond cutter, which is the super over finishing move of another of the other company's biggest stars. And they were like, did he think that he was the only one who found out there was another company? Like, no one would notice that he was doing these moves.
I mean,
and that's Mortal Engines. Mortal Engines really Billy Gunned it.
But alternately, Billy Gunn probably thought doing that was funny, right?
Probably, but it's never, like, mentioned on commentary, and it wasn't something that lasted long.
Yeah, probably told to stop. But yes, you're making a strong point here. So let's go through the plot of this. I feel like we're already skipping ahead to final thoughts in a lot of ways.
Okay. A thing that I genuinely like about this movie is the beginning, where it's like, hey, cities are tanks now. And that's kind of all the explanation we get, because Mortal Engines is a movie that trusts you. Mortal Engines was like, we know what the trailers are going to be. If you're watching this movie, you have agreed that you are going to see cities that are tanks. That is, we get like 30 seconds of explanation. It's like, hey, the apocalypse happened, and now cities are tanks.
Yes, I appreciate that the movie throws you right into the deep end.
Yeah, fuck yeah.
With London attacking and eating another city.
Yes.
And then we see how all of that works. We see the city part of the city consumed for fuel. And the people get brought into London, and they're told, you're going to have jobs, we're going to give you a place to live, you're part of London now, essentially.
Yeah.
And we also find out through some expository dialogue that London, which is the biggest, strongest city, crossed the land bridge into mainland Europe, which is the great hunting ground, to try to start eating up other cities. And it's like a great act of war. It's like a big deal that London did this. It's created a lot of enemies for London. Again, I think it's weird that there don't seem to be any other big cities.
Yeah.
Considering that they're on mainland Europe.
But resources are really scarce. So that's why cities have to move around, and London took all of the resources on the British Isles, so it had to come to mainland Europe, which you would think if resources were that scarce, they would just stop having a city that was also a monster truck, because it doesn't seem very efficient, but it's the premise of the movie, we've already bought in.
It's moving all the time. It never stops. You'd think they would stop and be like, hey, let's conserve some fuel. They never do that. It's so big. It's so
big. The one thing the movie does really well is it does scale really well,
well
I think.
One of the first things you see is London in comparison to this small mining village. And it just dwarfs it. It's, again, Star Wars. It's the Star Destroyer versus the little ship Leia's on. At the start
the blockade
of
Runner, Matt.
The Blockade Runner, yes. Mm-hmm. At the start of A New Hope. It's that comparison.
There's so much fucking Star Wars in this. It's hilarious.
So that's the one and only city battle we see in the whole movie.
The rest of the movie is going to be, okay, we're not going to show you any more cities fighting cities, but we are going to show you cities fighting their other natural enemy, walls.
Yes. So then we kind of shift into what is going on in London proper. Okay, inside the city. We find out that there is a huge hierarchy of people. There's a Lord Mayor. His name's Magnus Chrome.
Amazing. The names in this movie are wild.
There's a deputy mayor. His name is Thaddeus Valentine.
Mm-hmm.
He's played by Hugo Weaving.
A very completely normal name that a human would have.
One of the first things we see is him like on essentially the bridge of the city in like the drive room, and he's like making the commands to take in this other city.
Yeah.
But then we also see him greet all the other people. He has a daughter who seems to be of some standing in the city. Her name's Catherine, or Kate. She's often called Kate. We also see a guy named Tom Natsworthy, who we get the impression at first he's got some level of authority in London because he essentially is running the museum. But we come to find out he's sort of worked his way up to this position, and he's looked down on.
Classic working class.
Yes, very working class. But because of his knowledge, his intellect, he's worked his way up to this position in the museum. But one of the first things that happens in the movie is he gets demoted. And he ends up going to talk to Valentine, Thaddeus Valentine, about this and saying, like, hey, people have been stealing stuff out of the museum. I don't know why I'm getting demoted. Hey, you got one of those old power cells. Some old tech, which is something that's talked about a lot in the movie, because this movie takes place 1,400 years into the future.
It's so far into the future, but it's like it's unnecessarily far into the future. Basically so that they can do a joke about Minions, which is, I think, a very funny joke, actually.
They also do a joke about Twinkies.
Yes.
How Twinkies never go bad.
Yeah. Not as funny, but yes.
There's a part where the lead that we'll get to in a minute, Hester, eats a pack of Enkies because the packaging has worn off of the front. And it's got like a date of like 400 years earlier, but they still eat it and it's fine. Because the ancients' food never goes bad.
Yeah. It's basically in Fallout times.
It is basically in Fallout times. So there's a lot of information here at the top of the movie. We find out about this old tech, how Valentine is sort of slipping away with this power cell that he says he's going to dispose of, but he's not really doing. We find out about this weapon, this energy weapon, that Tom has found out about in reviewing old video files of the ancients that was used to destroy cities.
Yeah, it is what caused the apocalypse, which is, I believe, referred to as the 62nd War, which I think is actually a really intriguing little bit of setup where it's like, yeah, it's not like a prolonged nuclear thing. It's like the world ended in a minute because the weapons are that devastating.
Yes, and notably, North America is completely gone. Like, they call it a dead continent.
Yeah.
Because it seems to have been the hardest hit by this massive weapon.
Yeah. Which is dumb because that means that in Mortal Engines 2, they can't fight New York.
They could at least fight Paris. Where is Paris? That's what
I wanna... Paris? Where is Moscow? Because like there's what is the other city that's mentioned? Is it Archangel? Archangelsk.
Oh, okay. Okay.
Yeah.
But like you'd think that London would go toe-to-toe with one of the other big cities.
Yeah, that's what you want to see. You want to see Godzilla versus King Ghidorah. You know, you want to see London versus Moscow.
Very much so. Anyway, the city that London eats at the beginning of the movie has one particular person on it whose name is Hester Shaw. She's a young woman wearing a red mask over the bottom of her face.
She's dressed up as Netflix Electra.
Yes. Netflix or Electra and an assassin from an Assassin's Creed.
Uh-huh. That's her.
Her whole deal is she is there specifically to kill Thaddeus Valentine. So she finds Thaddeus Valentine and immediately tries to run him down and kill him. That leads into a giant chase sequence in the engines of London, where Valentine gets away and he pushes Hester down like a chute that doesn't kill her, but like sends her out of the city. Tom sees all this happen, so Valentine pushes him down the chute also.
Completely unnecessarily.
Well,
Because Tom is completely on Valentine's side and is also his daughter's boyfriend. So he has, like, every reason to believe him. And then he's like, hey, didn't she say something? Like, what was she saying? Like, it sounded like she said something really weird to you. And he's like, I'm just going to kick you out of the city's butthole.
Well, Hester also says something to Tom about how Valentine killed her mother.
Mm-hmm. But he absolutely doesn't believe her.
No.
At the beginning of the film.
She also reveals a big scar going across her face.
Hideous. JK. In the books, I think she is described as, like, missing her nose. It's very much a Tyrion situation.
It's very much a Tyrion Lannister situation, yes.
Where the young woman who plays Hester, who is...
Hera Hilmar.
Hera Hilmar, yes, who has a great name, by the way, is beautiful. And so when she is revealed to have this horrible scar that in the books has left her, like, with a with no nose, it's just, like, a scar that makes her look cool.
Yeah, pretty much.
Yeah.
Also, one thing I forgot to note, there are these signs all over London informing people that Anna Fang... who is the leader of the Anti-Traction League, she's wanted.
Yes.
For a bounty. So, Tom and Hester are now outside of the city, sitting in these humongous tracks.
Which I think is another great visual.
Yes. It took me a while to realize that these were tracks. Because they're so big. It's like they're in a canyon.
Yeah. It's the tracks of the city's tank treads.
It's a great look and another way of showing just how huge this tank city is. But we find out that, you know, well, basically Tom just essentially says, hey, help me get back to the city. Hester says, all right, we'll go together. We'll try to find some smaller city that can take you back to London.
Because she also wants to go back to London and kill Hugo Weaving.
Right. So they start walking. They find out, or Hester lets Tom know, that going south is bad. And they get picked up by this, I don't know what it is. The town is called Scuttlebug, but it's not really a town. Because it's underground, or
it's a hotel.
It's camouflaged to look like part of the ground.
Yeah, it's a big robot Shai-Hulud, is what it is.
It walks around on legs.
It's like it's like half hotel, half train, I guess.
Yeah, that's fair. And it's run by this older couple that at first seems nice, but guess what? They're not. They're slavers. So they lock Hester and Tom in a cell and take them to essentially a slave auction where they are meant to be sold. Meanwhile,
Mm-hmm.
Valentine gets on an airship and flies to this prison where he has discovered that someone from the Lazarus Initiative, Shrike, has been...
which is like the third name that you would come up with if you were trying to think of a name for a bad guy.
Has been banging around the walls of his cell saying Hester's name.
Yeah.
Now, obviously he wants Hester out of the picture. So he blows up the prison.
Yeah, which the prison that's already giving him this guy. Like, the warden's like, sure, you can take him. We can't really do anything with him. You know, he's a cybernorg. They don't say that. That's a Tom Scioli joke that I have stolen because I think it's very funny to call cyborgs cybernorgs. Then for no reason, he's like, well, I got to cover these tracks too. And he blows up the prison, which is a prison that walks around on spider legs. It's a giant spider prison. It's a giant robot spider prison. Already we have three different kinds of like mobile structure in this movie.
Oh, yeah. And this is, I guess there's a minor antagonist, but this is like major antagonist number two.
Yes.
Shrike comes walking out of the water and his eyes are like these big pulsing green lights and he screams for Hester.
If they made a bad Copernicus Jones movie, this is what he would look like.
You're actually not far off.
Yeah. Because he's got those big green eyes.
Look, if you do want to make a bad Copernicus Jones movie, fine. Just
get out of speech.
just pay me that licensing fee. Pay me for them rights. Anywho, Hester's about to get sold at this auction. And there's this big nasty guy who's bidding like eight of whatever the currency is.
Eight quatloos.
There, one thing about this is so much is lost from the book in the movie.
Mm-hmm.
Because it's talked about quite a bit that the currency, I think they're like quirks. I think they're called something like quirks. And what you don't know if you've only seen the movie is that there's a very good reason that they're called that. Because Mr. Quirk, there's a guy named Quirk who came up with the idea of how to put cities on wheels, on how to make city tank. So that's why all the currency is called Quirk, and why, like, every once in a while, Tom is like, oh, thank Quirk for that.
Yeah, I forgot that happened. That's so weird.
Yeah, his name is Nicholas Quirk in the book.
He's the first guy to ever ask, how do city be tank?
So he installed huge engines and wheels on London and enabled it to dismantle and eat other cities for resources. The technology rapidly spread and evolved into what is known as municipal Darwinism.
Yes, which they say in the movie, in which I was like, fuck yes. Let's do this shit.
So, it seems like quite a bit from the books gets lost in the movie, because Quirk actually does have meaning. But this guy's going to buy Hester for 8 quirks. But then somebody says 5,000 quirks. And guess who it is? That's right.
Is it the only other character that we have foreshadowed in this film?
It's Anna Fang, who apparently knows Hester.
Anna Fang, who looks like she is cosplaying as Travis Touchdown from No More Heroes. 1,000,000%, right?
You are not wrong. Great haircut.
No, she looks great, but she absolutely looks like she's cosplaying Travis Touchdown.
Great haircut. So she's going to buy Hester for 5,000 quirks, but then the auctioneer says, I know who you are, you're Anna Fang. You have a bounty on your head of 50,000 quirks, so you got to pay me 50,000 quirks to get her, or else I'm turning you in and getting the reward. But none of that matters, because then, like, one scene after we just saw him get out of prison, Shrike is there.
Now, does Shrike show up before or after Anna Faye mass murders these dudes?
I believe it is before.
Okay.
But I can't remember. Either way, it all breaks down into absolute chaos.
Yeah. Because this movie's like, hey, you know what we don't have yet is Wolverine.
That's true.
We should. What if Star Wars was Wolverine? And then we get Anna Faye, who is Wolverine.
So there's some fighting that happens here, but long story short, Anna Faye, Tom, and Hester leave. They manage to get away from there. And Shrike follows them on an airship. Like, kind of like a dirigible kind of thing. Back on London, we get more about how Valentine's actually a bad guy.
Shocking, I know, for Hugo Weaving to show up and start kicking people out of cities' buttholes and then be revealed to be a bad guy.
He has set up one of these huge weapons that we saw earlier in the movie inside St. Paul's Cathedral.
Which is the only London landmark that still exists after the destruction of the world, which I think is a real shame. Like, on the one hand, I think they do a really good job with London. Like, the front of the city tank, it actually looks like the Thundercats tank, but, like, because it has the two big lions on the front. But the only sort of recognizable landmark, because I read about this in the books, it's the only building that survived, is St. Paul's Cathedral, which is fine for a book, but, like, visually, London has so many cool and recognizable buildings.
Yeah, get the Gherkin in there.
Get the Gherkin! The Gherkin's great. Like, I feel like they could have done more to visually be like, hey, this is London. In a way that they don't quite do. Because we get the big flag. The big flag is on the city mouth.
They've got the big Union Jack on the mouth, yeah.
Yeah. On Mouth of City.
That's right, Mouth of City.
Yeah. But I think, again, it makes me wish, like that, which is kind of like, by the way, St. Paul's Cathedral. That's kind of like if Paris, if there was a city Paris, but it was the Louvre, was the only recognizable landmark.
Yeah, because you don't.
It's kind of not what you want to see.
You don't, yeah. Like, St. Paul's Cathedral is certainly a landmark. Is it the first landmark you think of when you think of London? No, it is not.
No. Which, again, is probably why it's what was chosen. Because, you know, they get to do something that's not Buckingham Palace or Big Ben or, yeah, like, the obvious things you would think of. But also, like, those are the things that you think of because it's what you want to see.
Yeah, like, if they did Paris and there wasn't an Eiffel Tower, you'd be like, what the fuck? Give me my money back.
Yeah, what the fuck, bro? Give me the Arc de Triomphe. Give me the Eiffel Tower. Then give me the Louvre if there's time.
Anna Faye takes Tom and Hester to Airhaven.
Airhaven is the dumbest thing in the movie.
Which Cloud City.
Yes, it is Cloud City. It is also highly flammable.
Yes. It's a big balloon.
Yeah. What if City was balloon, Matt?
And when they get to Airhaven, there are a bunch of signs that say, hey, don't shoot anything. No sparks, please. Because our whole thing will explode.
Which seems like a design flaw to me.
Yeah. Yeah, man.
We've just gotten used to the idea of what if City was tank. In fact, we haven't even gotten used to it. We're like okay with it. And then it's like, what if City was balloon? What if City was wall? What if prison was spider? Like, there's too much. What if hotel was Shai Hulud?
What if man was robot?
What if man was robot?
Airhaven is exposition town. Let's be clear. Because it's where Hester tells Tom the entire story of her mother, when earlier in the movie, she was like, we're not going to share our sad stories. That's not what's going to happen. But then yes. She tells Tom about her mother, whose name was Pandora.
Mm-hmm.
And what did she have?
She had a box.
She had a box.
And it was a bad box.
It was a box that had bad stuff in it. Because it was the box that was part of Medusa, which is the quantum energy weapon that was used in the 60-second war. When Valentine found out that Pandora had this box, because Valentine and Pandora were having a relationship.
Mm-hmm.
He killed her. Then he slashed Hester across the face and gave her those scars.
But very carefully.
Yes.
Was like, hey, I will make sure to not... Like, hang on, hold still. This is actually going to look pretty cool.
Then after that happened and Hester got away, she was found by Shrike, who raised her as his own daughter.
Yeah, Shrike, who is a literal remorseless killing machine. But since he was a RoboCop, he has, like, RoboCop memories of TJ Laser.
Uh-huh.
And so he's like, hang on, I think I might have been a dad. And so he, like, acquires a baby, which is Hester.
Except she's, like, 10. But he raises her, and because he knows that she's sad, they make a deal. Their deal is, he's going to kill her and turn her into RoboCop 2 so that she doesn't have to be sad anymore.
Yeah.
Here's what's wild about this.
Uh-huh.
Shrike is incredibly emotional.
Shrike is very sad.
There's so much said about how Shrike has no emotion in this. He's extremely emotional.
Yeah, his whole thing of, like, hunting down Hester is because he is sad.
Because
like, because he's sad about not...
Because she's sad.
Because she's sad. Yeah.
Wild.
Wild.
Anyway, Airhaven blows up.
Yeah. Yeah. Explosion Town, the town that explodes, blows up.
Because Shrike shows up there, tries to get Hester, which leads to a firefight in which the all of Airhaven is destroyed.
This is, I think, where you also find out that Tom works in the museum, but what he really wanted to do is be a pilot.
Oh, he's been saying
Tatooine.
He's been saying that since Act 1.
Yeah, but you know, Biggs got to go join the rebellion.
Yeah.
And he's stuck here. Because if there's the bright center of the universe, he's on the tank city it's furthest from.
He says something about wanting to have been an aviator in, like, the second scene he's in.
There is such a big deal. Like, I read a comic about John Constantine coming back after being gone for a while that did not make as big a deal about him putting on his jacket as this movie makes about Tom putting on a jacket and being like, I'm a pilot now.
He takes so long to put on a fucking jacket.
It's great.
Also, Shrike dies in this part.
Well, I'm glad that now that we had that evil dad reveal, that we're done with that part of the story. Folks, we're going to borrow the Guessatron 5000 from Apocrypals. Go ahead and put your guesses into the Guessatron 5000 and see which male character who is of an appropriate age that we have seen in this movie, which is all the ones we've mentioned, will also be revealed to be Hester's evil dad.
Also, I think just as they're leaving the Airhaven, Hester realizes that she has a necklace that her mother had for a long time that is a flash drive,
mm-hmm.
but it's actually a crash drive.
I forgot they call it crash drive.
It is essentially a kill switch for Medusa. If she plugs it into the Medusa device, she can turn it off and make it self-destruct. From Airhaven, Anna and all the rest, because On Airhaven, we're introduced to a whole other team of, like, rebels, right? The anti-tractionists.
Porkins.
Yeah.
Biggs. Wedge, I think, is in there.
They all go to the wall. The shield wall. Which
they go from the windows to the walls, Matt.
That's right. It protects the east from the western tank cities. Because the east never got into this.
Yeah, which is also the most hilarious thing about the movie is that they're like, yeah, cities had to become traction cities in order to survive. And that's why every city in Europe became tank. And then it's like, except there were a bunch of cities like 5 miles away that were like, that actually sounds dumb.
But they're not 5 miles away. They're like in China.
It is unspecified. I kind of got the idea that the wall was in, like, the Urals.
I believe it is. Maybe you're right. Maybe it's, like, the dividing line between Europe and Asia.
Yeah.
But it seems like London gets there in no time.
Yeah.
I'm sure in the book it takes a lot longer for London to get to the wall.
Yeah. But there is clearly a dividing line between... we had to put giant wheels on cities. And then, yeah, well, actually, resources are not too scarce here.
Anyway, London approaches the wall once Anna and her team get there. And Valentine is going to shoot the Death Star, mm-hmm. his Death Star in St. Paul's Cathedral, to destroy the wall. And he manages to get a couple of shots off.
Yeah, much like the Death Star.
Where
you get one to show how much it can do.
Yeah, it takes a big chunk out of the wall and destroys some aircrafts. But then Fang and the rest of her team, which includes Hester and Tom, they take their flying ships out and they manage to avoid another shot and make their way to London, where they shoot out a bunch of anti-air defenses that London has, and Hester manages to get to St. Paul's Cathedral.
You know, exactly like Star Wars. Exactly like Star Wars.
Anna holds off Valentine for a while and is mortally wounded, but she gives Hester enough time to plug in her crash drive and shut down the entire Medusa system. But Valentine says, nope, that's not the end. We're just going to ram the wall.
Brilliant. Love it.
So Tom has to fly his airplane into the Death Star's engines and blow those up with his aircraft, which he succeeds in doing. And in between that, Valentine lets Hester know that he's her real dad.
Yeah. I wasn't kidding. It's literally in order, Star Wars, Empire, and Jedi.
Valentine is in like a little escape ship thing, but it crashes to the ground and he gets crushed under the big treads of London as it comes to a halt.
Very ironic.
And because the only bad guy is dead, the Londoners and the people behind the wall make peace. And Hester and Tom fly off for more adventures. Chris, what do we got for high points of Mortal Engines?
It is a genuinely well-designed film. Like the thing that makes this the ideal movie for us, like the ideal movie for like people who kind of like to watch bad movies. It's very visually interesting. It's fun. It's fun to watch in a very like literal sense. London is a cool design. Like even though it doesn't have any other landmarks aside from St. Paul's Cathedral, like the big windshields that people crowd behind and the way they like cheer on London, like it's a sport. Like, all the design stuff is really good. And even, like, the weird little, like, slaver's market where they just look like a bunch of RC cars, like a bunch of giant RC cars, are fun. Like, everything looks good.
Yeah, it's not even just the special effects that look good, because London looks good. The one or two other tank cities we see look good. The, like, hotel train centipede looks good. The visual of just Hester and Tom being in those giant tracks is very cool. The characters are also well designed. The costumes are good. The hair is good. The look of Shrike, like you said, he looked like a Copernicus Jones in a bad movie, but he is an effective design for what he is.
Yeah.
Like, you get Hugo Weaving's deal as Valentine right away because of the way he looks. Hester is a striking design, especially when she's got her red mask on. Mm-hmm. Like, the costumes and the hair and makeup in this movie are very well done.
There's, like, one other really good visual thing that comes to mind, which is when they're actually approaching the wall. There's been this whole thing throughout the movie of this idea that beyond the wall, like, Western Asia, Eastern Asia, all, like, they've got resources. They don't have to, like, scrounge around for them. So they don't have to have the traction cities. And so when they approach the wall, you can see all the cities that tried to get through as these giant city-sized wrecked cars, which is a super cool visual. And I think is one of the few times in the movie that we get the idea of the scale of, like, this is a thing that's been happening for a while. This is why London is the only city left, even though it's not as fun for that to happen.
I also think the performances in this movie are mostly good. I think Hera Hilmar is good.
Yeah.
In her role as Hester. I think Hugo Weaving does exactly his Hugo Weaving bad guy thing.
He is. That is what he is hired to do.
Yeah, he did his job. I think Stephen Lang, who plays Shrike, injects Shrike with a certain level of pathos, even though he's supposed to be this emotionless creature.
Maybe a little too much.
Yeah. I think Tom is good. Like, Tom is a good, like, what's going on here kind of viewer identification character.
Yeah, he's kind of a dumbass, but he's never, like, frustratingly dumb.
Yeah, he just doesn't understand what's going on because he's been living in London and been naive this whole time.
Yeah.
I think he plays that well. Like, I don't think any of the acting performances are, like, bad.
No, not at all. I think, generally speaking, it's, like, it's well acted, and to their credit, they commit. Everybody commits to this movie. They are doing their level best to bring this vision to life. Which, why wouldn't they? Like, there's a chance this could be the next Lord of the Rings, you know?
Chris, what do we got for low points?
It's very poorly written. Like, I'm not even talking about the premise. I am 100% down with the premise. I think I have made that clear. Cities are tanks? Fuck yes. If you're listening to this, you know me. You know I'm down. But, like, there is a part in this movie, and I think there are so many little things and that are big things, honestly, that sum up how bad this movie is. One of them is that the same character has two evil dad reveals. Hester. She reveals that she was actually raised by Shrike, and that he is her evil dad, and then it is later revealed that that Valentine is her other evil dad.
Her evil biological dad.
There is a whole big thing made about Valentine's daughter, Katie. Kate. There's a whole big deal made about, like, how she's gonna find the truth. And, like, one of Valentine's, like, big things is he doesn't want his daughter involved in this big evil plot that he's doing. So there's a part where she, like, is like, investigating and, like, doing some reporter stuff, and then she finally finds this secret passage, and this guy's like, yeah, this secret passage is 1,000 steps, but it'll take you right up into St. Paul's Cathedral, so you can find out what's really going on in there. And so she climbs up this passage of 1,000 steps to get into St. Paul's Cathedral, because there's no other way for her to get in. She gets in, she sees that her dad is doing some evil stuff, and then she walks out the front door.
Yep.
It's bad.
If I may use another metaphor, this movie is a beautifully constructed skeleton of a movie. It's like when you see the construction site for a skyscraper, but all you're seeing is the I-beams. All you're seeing is kind of the steel understructure before it's fleshed out with, you know, what covers that? Windows and steel and the other things that make it a building. Because it's got lots of interesting ideas, lots of neat visuals, lots of plot threads that are barely touched on, and then left for something else.
Mm-hmm.
Like characters who you don't really learn anything about. What do we know about Anna Fang?
We find out her backstory, and it's very rote.
Yeah, there's not much to Anna Fang. We understand her because she's an archetype.
Yes, very much.
And
everyone in this movie is an archetype.
Yes. I mean, we find out a little bit about Hester, and we find out a little bit about Tom. But that's about it. We don't even really quite know why Valentine is so intent on knocking down the wall. I mean, I suppose he's trying to get the resources, but there's basically just another character who says, you're only in this for the power. And that's all, as far as we know, that is true. That is true of Valentine's motivations. There are so many things happening in this movie. There are so many ideas being brought into it that there's no room to flesh anything out.
Yeah.
And I think that's part of it being a book adaptation. Because like we talked about with the quirks, like you have to have read the book to know what the quirks are. I have a feeling that like if you read the book, you can fill in some of the gaps that are in this movie.
Mm-hmm.
But it's not Lord of the Rings. I'm sure the book was popular, but it came out in 2001. The movie didn't come out until 2018.
Also, like for a movie that is thematically about like a very kind of obvious and big colonialism metaphor. Like you and I talked about that when we started having a conversation about this movie, and then we had to stop because we were just doing the show but not recording it.
Yeah, I'm going to get to that a bit in final thoughts.
For a movie that has that as a pretty big theme, like it kind of gets, if not like outright racist, like mega stereotypical at the end when like the inscrutable Asian people show up and like are all dressed in like weird mishmash, like samurai / Zen Buddhist / Kung Fu outfits. And also are like, and we will forgive London for what it has done. Like it's very, again, I feel like that's part and parcel of the shorthand that we get where every character is an archetype. And they all exist as archetypes because they're in service to this big high concept. But then when you reduce, you can only reduce things down so far. And I feel like this movie definitely errs on that towards the end.
It's not cut to the bone. It's cut to the marrow.
Yeah, for sure.
All right, Chris, let's give some final thoughts.
I genuinely think this movie's fun to watch. It's not good. But I think it is exactly the kind of movie you've heard us say, like, hey, put this movie on at a party and you'll have a good time. I don't think you need to put this movie on at a party. You can just watch this movie. And if you go in knowing it's going to be kind of dumb, which you would probably know from the premise, then you're probably going to have a pretty good time watching it, even though it is objectively bad.
Chris, you brought up sort of the allegorical theme of this movie,
mm-hmm.
which is I think, very clearly something about British colonialism.
Yeah.
Like, there is a clear through line in this movie about British colonialism. And that's a good idea. There's something smart in that. But the movie biffs it and fumbles the ball and makes it real dumb.
Yeah.
That's this movie in a nutshell. Because the Asian people that the British are going to attack and take over their land, they're not South Asian. They're not Indian. They're not African. Which, in the period of British colonialism, those were the people that the British were the most antagonistic toward, that they took over their homelands. No, they're Chinese. What? What are you doing?
Yeah, which is, I think, this movie in a nutshell, right? Like, it doesn't quite do enough with its goofy sci-fi high concept. What if City was Tank? What if City ate City? What, London, King of Cities? And it doesn't quite do enough with its metaphorical high concept of here's a sci-fi version of why colonialism is bad.
Yeah, like, people can disagree about whether Pacific Rim is a good movie or not. Let me tell you what Pacific Rim gives you plenty of, though. Robot versus monster.
Yep.
You go into Pacific Rim expecting robot versus monster, and you get it. Mortal Engines withholds city versus city from you. And that is could not be more apparent than from the final battle being city versus wall.
Yeah. Which is really the second battle in the film.
Yeah.
It's interesting that you and I specifically are talking about this movie right now because we just recorded part of Comics Catch Up, which is another podcast that we do, and we talked about Omega Men and how thematically Omega Men is at heart like a discussion of how we all think we're good guys, we all think we're more entitled to limited resources than the other guy. Like even if it starts out as them, even though it starts out as theirs, we need it more.
Right? Omega Men is also ostensibly a story where a terrorist is the good guy, where in this, Anna Fang and the anti-tractionists are the good guys.
Yeah. That is explored in Omega Men, and it's only kind of vaguely waved at in this, where it's like, yeah, they need, like, London needs the resources, and there's... To its credit, I think the bits where, like, the people of London are cheering on the destruction of another city, and then, you know, the city itself is cannibalized, but also the population is cannibalized, and they become Londoners. I think there's a lot of, like, really interesting metaphor there that the movie just does not really do anything with. Like, and there's a fine line between... We're going to do this in a subtle way and not, like, underline it and then making a movie where a city's a tank, which is not the time for subtlety. Subtlety is for cowards, as we all know.
Mortal Engines is your friend that it's very frustrating to have a conversation with, because as soon as you hit a topic where you're like, okay, let's talk more about that, let's get to the heart of that, they've moved on. They're talking about something else, and you just have to keep up.
Yeah, absolutely watch it. Like, honestly, super high recommendation. I actually wrote a piece for Looper, I think, called – I think it was called Mortal – or the title that I gave it that ended up being changed was Mortal Engines is the dumbest movie of the year, and I love it. So absolutely watch it. It's super fun. Don't go to Redbox. Catch it on the home box office. But yeah, it's kind of a hoot.
All right, everybody, that's it for this episode of Movie Fighters. We watched Mortal Engines. Hey, watch it too if you feel like it. We'll be back in June with something else. We don't know what it's going to be, but it'll be fun.
If you have a suggestion, let us know.
Yeah, absolutely. Let us know if you have a suggestion. You can email us at moviefighterscast@gmail.com. We're also on Tumblr at moviefighterscast.tumblr.com. Mostly what we post there is the snacks we eat for snack situation. But it is also a place where you can get in touch with us about the show. We'll tell you where you can find us online. We don't always do this in an episode, but for me, you can go to mattdwilson.net to find links to everything that I do. Chris, where can people find you?
People can find me at the-isb.com. That has links to everything that I do, including my Looper author page. So if you want to go and find that piece that I wrote, if you're not sick of me talking about Mortal Engines just yet after the past hour, then you can find that there along with everything else that I write online.
See you in June, everybody.
Bye. Have a great month. We love you. Cities are tanks now.
Media production.